You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles Hunting Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and I can't believe that 2024 marks 10 years of podcasting. Over the last decade, I have had the pleasure of talking with hundreds upon hundreds of passionate outdoors men and women who share the same excitement for hunting as I do. Whether you hunt public lands or private property, shoot traditional archery equipment or high-powered rifles, we all have one thing in common, and that's our love for the great outdoors. This year, I plan on continuing that tradition and bringing educational and entertaining content to your ears. Thank you for your continued support, and I hope you all have the best seasons of your life. Good vibes in, good vibes out. Right, here we go again, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and today we're going to be talking about habitat work. This is the time of year where it's not too hot. There's no vegetation on the ground. Ticks really aren't out quite yet, you know, especially in the Midwest, but we're getting to a stage where people are going to, you know, start shifting towards turkey hunting. But right now, it has always been the best time of year to do habitat work. Some would argue that habitat work is supposed to be done all year round. But for a majority of the guys, like prescribed fire, hinge cutting, that kind of stuff takes, you know, place over the February, March time frame. And so we're going to talk about habitat today. And because I don't know anything about habitat work, because I've never had the ability to do any habitat work, we're going to be talking with a guy who loves doing habitat work, Mr. Skip Sly. He is a landowner who has the ability to basically just do whatever he wants on the properties. He has a big enough property where he can experiment with habitat improvement projects, where, you know, he has done everything from renovating ponds to hinge cutting to, you know, planting different types of trees and shrubbery, messing around with soil and things like that. And so today's conversation is all about habitat work. We kick off the episode with a little bit of a BS session, but then later on in the episode, we dive into his approach to habitat work. And this is the Habitat Podcast for the year. I don't do very many of these because my knowledge of habitat work is low compared to other people. And so I rely on other people who have experience and education in habitat to come on and share their knowledge. So that's what today's episode is about. Before we get into today's episode, though, I'm going to quickly run through all of the partners. And I would really appreciate if you would at least go to their websites and visit their websites, and take a look at the products that they offer, because, you know, maybe it's something you might buy. And when you buy something, it lets them know that you've heard from me on this podcast and that the partnership that we've created is worth it. That would just help me out just a little bit. So if you're looking for a saddle hunting accessories, it's turkey season. They have a turkey vest. Go to tetherednation.com. Take a look at everything that they offer. Awesome company, awesome people. Wasparchery.com. If you are a turkey hunter and you need a really good expandable broadhead, why don't you go check out the J Jackhammer by Wasp, wasparchery.com. They have other fixed blade heads as well. My opinion, some of the best blades on the market. Wasparchery.com, discount code NFC20. If you are looking for a red dot for your turkey shotgun, go take a look at vortexoptics.com. Very high quality product, very high quality people that run that company. They have a VIP warranty where if it breaks or you smash it or step on it, it will be replaced for free and then shipped back to you. Vortexoptics.com. You can go to eurooptic.com. This is a website, and they've given me a discount code for this website, eurooptic.com, and I believe the discount code is 9FINGER10, the number 9, the word finger, and then the number 10 at the end of it, and that's a 10% discount for that website only. CodeBlueSense.com, I have a discount code NFC20. That's going to get you 20% off of all their real or synthetic deer urines. They have the Rope-A-Dope system, which I'm a huge fan of. So go check out all of the products that they offer. The Woodman's Pal, that is a machete slash habitat tool that you can keep in your truck or your backpack. And I use it for hacking limbs out of the way, to create access routes, to clear out trail camera locations, to clear out stand locations, even certain fence crossings where I need to clear some brush, to hop a fence, to get to my tree stand location. So woodmanspal.com. Huntworth has, in my opinion, one of the best layering systems at the highest quality on the market. Now, there's the elite brands that everybody else knows about, right? But these guys are sitting with a quality of about 90% of those, but about 50% of the cost associated with these products. And their layering system is outstanding. Look, they have awesome base layers that I used this whole past year. I'm a huge fan of their pants for Western hunting. They have awesome camo as well. And so go check out huntworthgear.com and be sure to take advantage of their spring turkey sale that's going on site-wide right now. Other than that, fullsneakgear.com, that's my business. Do me a big favor, go check out the website, fullsneakgear.com. Take a look at all the t-shirts that I currently have available and do me a favor, buy one. And I will send it to you and you will love it. And so That part of my life is I started that company because I wanted to diversify a little bit of my income. And so I have I have these t-shirts for sale, and really what that money, the money that I make from that, goes to my family so that I can make them happy so that I can hunt more. And so I wish I could have renamed the company instead of Full Sneak, like renamed it Huntmore or something like that, just so I can go hunt more. You buy this product and I get to benefit from it because I can hunt more. So I don't know. Anyway, huge shout out to Skip for taking time out of his day. Huge shout out to all of you for taking time out of your day to download and listen. If you could do me a big favor and go to iTunes or wherever you download your podcast, leave a 5-star review. Let everybody know that you enjoy this podcast. Follow me on Instagram. And if you want to be a guest or you have a kick-ass story to tell, do me a favor and hit me up on Instagram and we can get something lined up. Last but not least, keep an eye out for something that I'm going to be doing called Hound Dog Podcast Network. Okay. If you are a hound hunter, if you raise hounds, if you use hounds to hunt, whether that's deer, predators, pheasants, whether they're a true hound, or if that you're, you love retrievers and you feel like you want to do a podcast, I got this new network that we're working on, and we would love to entertain the idea of you hosting a hound or dog related podcast on the Sportsman's Empire. So hit me up if you know anyone who would be interested in that. I would love to talk with you. Outside of that, man, it's all about good vibes. Good vibes in, good vibes out. And let's get into today's episode. 3, 2, 1. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the 9-Finger Chronicles. And today I am joined by the one and only Skip Sly. Skip, what do you know, man?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Just another swamped week at the farm, and being at the Classic all 3 days is not something I normally do, but I went to those 3 days, and then I had to help Buddy for 2 days, so now I'm like looking at my list today on all the stuff I have to catch up on. It's mind-boggling busy, but oh, yeah. I mean good busy, but
yeah,
good
yeah.
job. 5 days out of the loop, just the list gets crazy.
Yeah, so I'm looking at the wall of all these giant bucks behind you. I know you're a whitetail nut. I know you love doing everything under the sun when it comes to whitetails, but it's springtime. Do you get jacked up yep. about turkeys at all?
No.
No?
I get jacked up about whitetails. I'm whitetails right now. Like, this is go time. This is when you make the difference.
Yeah.
This is when I go hard on whitetails. Everybody's like, I go hard in November. No, this is when I go hard, and I love it. I mean, before this podcast and after I leave, I'll be working on the farm, whether it's farm related or deer hunting related, you know. Yeah. So, no, this is full-time whitetails. And when guys are turkey hunting on my farm, usually they'll ask me for permission, and then they're like walking by me or driving by me while I'm doing chores so they can go play turkey hunting.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't have time for it.
Okay.
But with my son, I will go.
Yeah.
But I don't know how to do it, really.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the same with me. Like, I go turkey hunting because I can't go whitetail hunting right now. And so now that my daughter is old enough, like, I think after I get done recording today, I'm going to go buy a 410 so she can shoot something. I think she can handle a 20 gauge, but I think a 410 is going to be a little bit more her style. And so I'm going to go check out one of those. But she loves turkey hunting, and because she loves turkey hunting, then I love turkey hunting. And basically it's just to hang out with her and my son. So
same with me.
Yeah.
And like when I went turkey hunting with my son last year, I called a buddy of mine and I just said, what do I need? Like a hardcore turkey guy. And we went and sat in one of my deer blinds.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I know they'll come by here. So we almost hunted them like deer.
Yeah.
Not efficient, not great.
Yeah.
My turkey hunting skills on a scale of 1 to 10 would be a 0 or a 1. It'd be awful.
Dude, I tell you this, something about turkey hunting. And I know there's some guys out there who listen to this who are hardcore turkey guys, and they'll probably crucify me for what I'm about to say. But this is no joke, and I've told this story before. I was on a cornfield. I was driving by a cornfield, and there was a black garbage sack that was stuck on a corn stalk and in the wind, and it was big and puffed up, and it was plastic. And there was a strutting tom strutting around it. I went around the corner, dropped down in the ditch, popped up on the other side, and started calling, and that tom came in, and I shot him. And it was because he was in a field strutting around a garbage bag. And
that's all you need. How easy they are to hunt.
That's, you know, right? I mean, is there any real strategy to turkey hunting?
I mean, the guys that come here say there is, and they're excellent turkey hunters, and they usually shoot. They all shoot their birds, but
yeah.
You know, I've shot some, but it's been in the fall when I'm in the tree stand for deer, and their eyesight is so crazy good when I'm in a tree stand, and I just look at them like, hey, there's dinner, and I try and sit really still, and then I'll shoot some with a bow. So
yeah,
I've got big turkeys, but it's more just for dinner.
Yeah,
out of my tree stand.
Love it. All right, so you mentioned that you were at the Iowa Deer Classic the entire all 3 days, and you gave a presentation that I know you sent it to me before you gave it, looked over it. It looked really, really well. Unfortunately, I had state wrestling with my daughter, so I wasn't able to make it to the classic this year. What was that presentation about? And then what was the response from the people who listened to that?
So just call it Keep Iowa Great. Growing the movement on hunters that care, and really just getting hunters together, because for decades in other states, hunters have not had organizations to band together and grow as a movement and be represented as a movement. The states that have had it, the organizations have been pretty minimal or ineffective. So what we're trying to do is different organizations in Iowa, like Iowa Sportsman's Club, they're trying to get as organized and as funded as the special interests are. So they get very organized, and they have been. That's why all these other states have been ruined, is because they've been so well organized and so well funded. And they're like, yeah, we'll pay for a lobbyist. And that's what all the special interest strategy is. So now we're funded. We the people, the hunters, are funded, and we're growing. And we're on equal footing now with these special interests. And I would say we can probably roll over a lot of these special interests and stop them dead in their tracks. So we will. And the reception was absolutely unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I would say I've been involved in this topic for 20-plus years. I mean, I used to fight the Michigan DNR on things and try and get guys, you know, sign petitions. And I'd write letters and have little debates with them when I was a young punk. But it really didn't do anything. And even then I was like, the chances are so slim. But now the tides have turned, and just the amount, the response and the people that are like, that show up, it's incredible. It's incredible the movement that has just started, because people are like, wow, there is a path. There's actually a way to do this. Mm-hmm. And we have a voice. And the people are responding like, please, I'm sick of seeing things ruined. Let's make it great. And the reception's unbelievable.
Yeah. That's awesome. And I think that's an example of what can happen if you organize and band together, right?
And, absolutely.
And what depending on whatever topic it is. Now, the thing that I was interested about is some of these rules and regulations that, you know, let's say like the crossbow companies, right? They have lobbyists. Raven Crossbows, or the company that owns them, has lobbyists in Iowa or working in Iowa to try to get crossbows passed. Now, when you brought this up in your meetings or in these presentations about, you know, outside interests trying to push legislation on the state of Iowa surrounding, you know, the natural resources and rules and regulations, what kind of feedback did you get from that?
It just opened people's eyes. They were like, I had no idea that that's how it went through. Yeah. And a lot of people in other states are like, you know, like my buddies in Minnesota were like, hey, I just woke up one day and crossbows got passed. How did that happen? They don't even know.
Yeah.
Nobody understands the process. And it's like, that was an easy one for Raven. They just got a couple guys to advocate for them. They got a couple politicians in their pocket. They snuck it in a bill. They avoided all the public debate on it fundamentally. But people are like, now they're realizing like, yeah, I have woke up a lot of times and seen new laws that I'm like, how did that come about? And now people, it's just being exposed. And that was our goal, just talk about it.
Yeah.
This is how things get bad. Well, the same way they got bad is going to be the same way they get better, which, you know, the way they got bad is a special interest group targeted these states to make money, and they use money and organization to ruin these states so they could get what they want. Well, we're using money and people and organizing to do good things, though.
Yeah.
So, you know, money can do good things and bad things. And I would say money is fundamentally the one thing that has caused all these states to be ruined. Money, you can trace it down to that in almost every single state. But money can also be the thing that fixes it, too. And it there was a point where I'm like, you know, writing in is great, and it is. It's huge. But there's only so much that can be done. There's limits to that. Because if a politician's saying, okay, I got these guys writing in, that's great, but I also got all this other side throwing me money in different forms, or, you know, lobbying like crazy and donating to me, that's really hard to fight against.
Yeah.
So we can fight back with money now. And it's not a huge amount of money either. It's not massive amounts. Any of these states, it's in the tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And it's like with what hunters spend on things, like a little piece of ground or I mean, the economies that revolve around hunting, the amount to make the quality better across the whole state, which would lift the economics up, the dollars up for the whole state, the opportunities for everybody, it's a drop in the bucket. You know, to do the right thing costs very little.
Yeah. And so there was a number. I can't remember if it was on the presentation or if it was something that you sent me personally, but 11-0 as far as explain what I'm talking about, 11-0.
Yep. So last year, they had 9 bad bills that came out. Rifles for turkeys, crossbows for this. There are a couple crossbow bills. More tags for these special interests, outfitter stuff. Last year was just filled with all sorts of crazy stuff. And I met with the legislators that, I mean, a large group of them. I met with a group at one point, and they're like, listen, these 5 out of the 9 last year, there's no chance they're going to stop these. And even some people on our side, even talking with folks in the DNR or whoever, I mean, that were not in favor of these things, they have to be neutral, but they're like, I think these are going to pass. Well, we got the hunters organized, and I say we, everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, the hunters woke up, which did not happen before, that the politicians didn't hear from them. They woke up and rode in and went to the Capitol. I got to debate all these issues, all these bad bills. I went for every one of them. And I would get invited to debate these things, and like I got to debate the Raven folks or whatever. And we defeated all of them last year. So it was 9-0. And the 5 that they're like, this will get through, you're not going to defeat it. We defeated all 5 of those.
That's awesome.
So the hunters that are like, well, things can't change, you know, they're going to get their way. I don't believe that. And we proved them wrong.
Yeah.
And I get so sick of that mindset, that defeatist mindset.
Yeah.
It does no good. And if you get your butt going and fight fire with fire. And here's the thing. Now that we have money on our side and we have organization on our side, and we're just on equal footing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you just weigh it out. You say, okay, we're on equal footing. But one group, us, has the truth.
Yeah.
And we just care about the resource.
Yeah.
The other guys, all they care about is money.
Yeah.
They just want me. And they don't even live here. They don't even vote here.
Yeah.
So who wins? When you have the truth on equal footing, mm-hmm. you're going to destroy him every time.
Yeah.
So that's why any biological argument across the Midwest, if people have it, on making the hunting better and improving the age class, improving, just lifting up the whole system that's degraded, people can fix that stuff. Absolutely can fix it. And 15, 20 years ago, I wouldn't have said that. But absolutely, I've never felt a revolution like this. And I've been obsessed with this stuff for 30 years, and I've never felt a moment like the last few years. The hunters have woken up.
Yeah. And that has a lot to do with the Iowa Bow Hunters Association and what is that, the Iowa Sportsman Club that you were talking for?
Both of them are fantastic. Everybody listening to this should be a member of both of those.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's just be honest about it. I mean, they need funds. They pay now a full-time lobbyist to go there and speak up for hunters. So the guys that are like, well, I don't know how to make a difference. Okay, write them a check. If it's $10, fine. If it's $100, fine. If you can afford $1,000, it's going right to Iowa causes to improve things for Iowa.
Yeah.
And both improve it and defend us. And I would say 2 years ago, it was just defense. It was just defense. Now we're on offense. And we have most of the legislators that have a say in things where I would have said a couple years ago, yeah, these guys are scumbags, sellouts, they're corrupt. They want to work with us. They actually, that is one thing that where my perspective has changed. When these guys understand the facts, and here's what I was very impressed with dealing with the legislators. They were more humble than I expected. Like, hey, I don't hunt. I don't hear from hunters. I just hear from angry farmers, and I hear from the special interests. Thank you for explaining this. And you go there with the information and the data, and like even the harvest data, like, listen, we're down, we're half of what we were in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't need to just kill every deer. When you explain this to them and just show them simple facts, they're like, I'm not a hunter, and I appreciate you hearing about this. You can change their mind. I mean, they're very open to it. And the amount of meetings we've had with the different legislators, and we've got a lot more scheduled, is astounding. And we're making huge differences based on facts and just based on the truth. And it's refreshing to them. I mean, their words,
yeah,
that they get to hear from the hunters who care, as opposed to just the special interests that just want to exploit our state.
Yeah. Yeah, man, it's so awesome to hear the results and see all the hard work start to pay off. The thing that I cannot say enough is, if you're unhappy with how your state is being run and the natural resources that the Department of Natural Resources manage, the laws and rules and regulations that you guys have in your state, you can change it. You can definitely course correct your state if you get enough people to band together.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Missouri, Ohio, little tweaks in Kansas. I think those three states are going to make some changes. I don't think none of this stuff's overnight.
Yeah.
But there were, you know, any state that's been ruined didn't get ruined overnight either.
Exactly.
It just takes a little bit of time. It takes a little bit of work. You know, the people who just want the easy button overnight, no, that's not how it works. Yeah. But like very doable goals, though, like let's fix these common sense things that have data behind it. Like a state saying, hey, Iowa knows what they're doing with regulations. Let's copy some of their regulations.
Yeah.
And some of these states that are like, nope, we got to have rifles out early to mid November. It's madness.
Yeah.
You guys can change that. You need to work with education. You need to talk amongst the hunters, and you'll never have 100% consensus.
Yeah.
You'll have groups that are like, nope, it's always sucked here. It's always been in the middle of the rut, rifles or guns. It's always been total disaster. So it needs to stay that way. Well, you're gonna argue with those guys. And there's no logic behind it, but it can be fixed. And let's start talking about it. Actually, there's data that says if we do shift it, this magic date on the calendar, it would be better for everybody.
Yeah.
Not the guy with just 5,000 acres that locks it up. It'd be better for everybody. More opportunities for everybody.
Yeah.
The everyday hunter would have more opportunities. So wake up, people, and people are waking up. So absolutely. I know things can change. I know it.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we go any further into this topic and you start to just get fired up and start to rage, we're going to change the topic now, because I brought you in because I wanted to talk about your farms, or the farm that you have. And we drove around it and I was very impressed with what I saw. I think I was more like, one thing that really stood out to me, and one thing that I wanted to, I might have to lean on you a little bit for, is the ponds that you have. They all look so fishable, and I want to go fishing on one of your ponds sometime. So I might have to lean on you a little bit and see if I can make that happen.
That's for the ponds are for other people. Again, I don't really have time for fishing. I used to be a hardcore fisherman. I mean, I loved it.
Yeah.
But I just love being outdoors, period. Yeah. That's how I got into hunting.
Yeah.
Like, I was a kid in the city. I'd take my bike with a net, and I'd just drive out of town, and we'd go, like, catch turtles and frogs, and then I'd bring them back to my house, and we'd turn our bathtub into, like, lily pads, and my mom would freak out. The house was full of turtles and frogs and snakes. And those little kiddie pools, we put those in the backyard. I want to turn my my house into a zoo. So I've always been the nature boy. And, you know, I'll put ponds on my farm so other people can fish. I used to do it a lot. I just run out of time. Now I want the kids to be able to fish, though. And I want friends to be able to fish, because the more we can do things in nature, I just think it's great for the kids. I mean, as opposed to name anything else out that the kids are getting into with electronics and video games, just sitting there and all day. I mean, I love seeing the kids get off of that junk and get into this. And I got into deer hunting not because somebody's like, hey, I'm going to take you deer hunting. I got into it because I just like being outdoors. Yeah. You know, nobody where I grew up, even my friends or family, deer hunted. You know, it's just, I like being outdoors. And then somebody's like, hey, let's go squirrel hunting. I'm like, okay, I'll squirrel hunt. And next thing you know, I saw a deer when I was squirrel hunting. And then somebody's like, you could actually go hunt for those deer. And I just picked it up on my own. So it's just the love of being outdoors. Yeah. And I would say, you know, I sit here and talk about regulations and all this stuff, but my passion, by far, my favorite thing, period, is habitat, conservation, environment. I'm an environmental nut. I'm a right winger, conservative, but conservative and conservation go together. Mm-hmm. Leaving the farms a better place than I found them. Doing everything I can to make these farms top tier. That's what I love. And you know, I was blessed beyond belief to fire myself from my job 10 or 15 years ago, so I can just do this every day.
Yeah.
Didn't think it was possible, but that's what I do every day, is make farms better.
Yeah. All right. I want to kind of hit rewind, and I want to throw out kind of a hypothetical scenario here. You still own all the ground that you own, but it has never been managed in any way, shape, or form. Basically, it's just a place where deer live and maybe the farming, right? The tillable ground gets farmed. Is there an order through all your experimentation, through all the habitat work that you've done throughout the years and the knowledge that you've gained, is there an order or a process in which the habitat work that you do on your farms has the greatest impact?
I would say yes. And, you know, there's so many different approaches to habitat, to transforming a farm. There's a million different opinions. And I'll say one thing, and I might leave out a lot of context too. Like, you know, it depends if somebody lives close by it, how much time do they have? But I mean, any farm I go on, if I'm able, and I am because I own them, but you know, timber stand improvement of some form, and that's a huge can of worms on what that all is. But I will go in and do timber work, and for real simplistic sake, making your timber thicker, opening up the canopy by removing poor quality trees like elm, bitternut hickory, ironwood, a little bit of shagbark hickory that's growing too thick. Just picking some junkier species and kind of trashing a little bit of hinge cutting, a little bit of opening the canopy up, stuff like that is number one on my list, along with food being number two. And I don't necessarily myself, I don't plant food plots for me to be like, okay, I'm going to shoot a buck on this food plot. I do it for health and for keeping deer safe and for keeping deer on my farm and also feeding them 365 days a year. And I just do a variety of diverse food plots. And I understand that most people can't do that. So it's just like, okay, whatever you have to work with, maybe it's a permission farm. If you can be like, make it really easy on the farmer and say, hey, would you leave a little bit of standing crops and I'll pay you well to leave those? Because if you try and nickel and dime them, I think there's this many bushels and you don't have to combine it, so I should pay less. No. Pay him well, because he doesn't want to deal with this stuff. And so food would be key. Food and timber stand improvement, hands down, are the first things I do to start out my farm. And that just keeps deer centralized in my farm. It keeps them safe. And when I get a new farm, a lot of times it doesn't even have a buck I want to shoot. The farm I have now sucked when I bought it. I mean, it was awful. And I had some buddies that leased it long ago for 3 or 4 years. And like, yeah, we dropped the farm, the lease on your farm just because it was junk. And it was, but it took a lot of work and this farm's great. But I could do this again and again and again to different farms, and I do. So, you know, food and timber work are key. And then the first year, I don't go piss pound on my farm because I want it to get better, and I want the deer to start feeling safe, and I don't want to run them off. You know, if there's 2 and 3 year olds or whatever, I want them to learn that my farm's safe, and I don't want them to get shot by the neighbors. And some of that you're never going to control at all. But the more deer I can keep safe, the better.
Yeah.
And get them to the older age class.
Yeah. And so is there a strategy, you know, because when it comes to habitat for deer, right, safety, food, water, and, you know, we all hunt bucks. So a doe population, right? And so
yep.
Is there a specific thing that you have done on your farm that has generated the largest impact, specifically if food plots trump hinge cutting, or hinge cutting trumps, I don't know, like planting CRP or something like that?
So hands down, I'll go out of the box.
Okay.
Like not even close. And the number one thing is trigger management, period.
Yep.
And it's like, wait, that's not what he was asking. It is, though.
Yeah.
All these guys that are like, I did all these things, but that buck, I couldn't contain myself. I had to shoot him. He was too young. It's not what I wanted to shoot, but I couldn't hold back.
Yeah.
Trigger management. Mm-hmm. Letting these deer get to an older age class. And deer that are tempting, that whatever your goals are, if your goals were, I want to shoot three-year-olds, and not what mine are, but if that's what they are, whatever they are,
yeah,
and there's a good two-year-old, you got to be able to let them go.
Yeah.
And that's one that sounds so obvious, like, come on, but it's huge. That's why most farms in the country are ruined, is because people don't have trigger management. Mm-hmm. Well, if I don't shoot them, the neighbor's gonna shoot them. And
yeah,
I couldn't, you know, whatever. I mean, if you want to do it, that's fine. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just what I do. But I want older deer. I want a balanced age class. So I'm very, very disciplined. And then next, just not over hunting my farm. I just kind of stay around the edges and for the first couple of years. And if there's nothing I want to hunt, well, I don't put all my eggs in one basket. Like people like, well, I want to hunt by Skip Farm, if somebody were to say that. Well, I hunt all over the place, and I might get a deer 10 miles from here. It doesn't mean that the farm behind my house in any given year has a giant buck. A lot, sometimes it doesn't. So, you know, I would say if you're making the habitat and the food exceptional, which are, it's a whole can of worms, but diverse food, exceptional cover, thermal cover, bedding cover, you name it, undisturbed, and hunting it correctly, you know, farm's generally going to get considerably better than what you found it. I mean, I'll pull the cattle off there. Cattle and deer get along. No, they don't. Cattle ruin land. They ruin it, destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. Like, yeah, you know, my farm was okay, and they're, you know, we let cattle in during this time. You pull those cattle off, and that's what I do, and that farm will jump up for the quality of whitetails that utilize it, and the amount of whitetails that utilize it.
That's hilarious that you say that, because when I was at your farm, you were putting in a fence to hold cattle.
Yeah. So there's a couple spots where I'm like, there's nothing there. There literally is nothing there. And I have ag ground too, where you're like, hey, how's your ag ground for hunting? It's okay. But I have farms that are, I have farms and I have parts of my farms that do nothing. And it's like, yeah, the chance that it could even be decent habitat, just obscure examples of where, you know, it'd take years and years and years. And I have a little bit of balance in me, like 0.001% is going to put something towards cattle pasture. And I mean, it's just the worst of the worst. And okay, I can raise a few cattle for us to eat, or this one, there's some families that are not well off, and they're struggling. And I said, hey, You guys can run cattle in there for free. You know, maybe help me with the fence. Maybe if I want some beef sometime at some point in the future, we'll work something out. But I kind of more did that for being helpful. Ruined soil too. So
yeah,
I'm going to rotationally graze them.
Yep.
And try and build up the soil rotationally. Does that fit into deer hunting? No,
yeah.
No, it doesn't at all.
Yeah.
But just I have enough ground where I can monkey around with that a little bit.
Yeah,
so,
I got you.
Yeah, a little contradictory.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So you mentioned there was a term that like selective, like being selective of where you are trying to improve this said habitat. Are there specific locations within a property or terrain feature that you focus on?
I would say the most open areas, like forested areas, you can have the biggest impact there. The deer usage will probably be fairly minimal. And you know, there might be let's call it a 40-acre wide open piece of timber that one buck periodically beds in.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be a couple ideal spots for him to bed where he likes, you know, right on the crest of a ridge or something.
Yeah.
Well, say there's two good bedding areas that he likes. Well, I'll open that place up enough and put enough trash on the ground and back cover, thermal cover, and new browse where all of a sudden it's like, okay, two or three bucks, mature bucks, frequent this area now, and it's loaded with deer beds, and it's loaded with food and thermal cover, and my ground will just house considerably more mature bucks.
Yeah.
So the carrying capacity for mature bucks and the carrying capacity for deer, I can greatly enhance that. Everybody's like, this is how many deer per square mile or how many bucks or whatever that a farm should have. Well, one farm can be vastly different than another. If you have exceptionally more browse, you know, if your browse is 1 to 200 pounds per acre versus 2 to 3,000, well, one farm's going to hold more deer and be able to feed more deer. Same with crops and food plots. And still to this day, my farm is way below carrying capacity. I would like to actually have the number come up. And I would say most of Iowa and our surrounding states are, I'd say the vast majority, with exception, are vastly below carrying capacity. And if you were close to carrying capacity, because I love whitetails, I love deer, and there's more to it than this, but I would rather improve the habitat, improve the food and the natural browse to give them optimal nutrition than just trying to knock back the population so they, you know, did better on the very little browse that I had and the very little amount of food. I'd rather increase, you know, the nutrition on the whole farm so it could sustain a larger population. And there's definitely problems where people don't do anything and the populations explode and they destroy the browse. But my farm has a good amount of deer and I still have amazing oak regeneration. The natural browse is ample, but I put a lot of work in it. And there's a lot of knowledge that goes behind that. And, you know, a private forester or a forester of some type would be able to help there. But I would say, you know, one little side topic is I think a lot of the deer population in the Midwest, people have shot way too many does and it's gotten far too low.
Yeah.
And specifically in Iowa, I think it's a big problem. I mean, we hear shoot all the does and kill them all. And it's probably, you know, I understand that to some extent, I get it to some extent, but that pendulum has swung too far the other way.
Yeah. Yeah. I can remember early 2000s, late 90s. And I bet you back then in Southern, when did you come to Southern Iowa?
2000.
Okay. 2000. So right around that time frame, man, the numbers were high where I was on. I mean, like I was seeing 25, probably does, just does, 25 more deer in a sit. And this isn't the same five deer walking in a circle around my stand. I mean, I was seeing tons of deer. Something happened. Maybe it was a little disease. Maybe it was a little bit like really good shotgun seasons, maybe, or like I know
tag quotas.
Yeah, tag quotas and things like that. And then that dropped down drastically. And now I think we're starting to come out of that dip. That's just my opinion. I think we're slowly coming out of it to where, like you said, the term carrying capacity is coming back up just a little bit.
Yeah, people don't realize that if you dial in your habitat really well, you're most 99% of the farms I go on, people I talk to, farms I see, are not even close to carrying capacity. My own farm included, it's not even close. And yeah, I mean, if you look at just the data, you know, 2005, we shot roughly a little over 200,000 deer in the state of Iowa. Well, we're about half that now, you know, a little bit more than half that, but
yeah,
you know, half as many.
Yeah.
And people are like, yeah, it's harder to find a mature buck. Harder, not impossible, but harder.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're shooting half as many deer.
Yeah. Yeah. What about, this is kind of in regards to carrying capacity, where let's say you create the bedding for them, but you don't have the food source. And what I mean by food source, I mean the additional food source of like food plots, or you leave ag standing and it's more of a natural type browse scenario. Is the carrying capacity with food higher than opposed to without additional food?
So natural browse is going to be still your staple component of any deer's diet. It's going to be at least 50% of their diet. I don't care if you have cornfields, bean fields, whatever, clovers, alfalfa, it's still going to be half. So, you know, and literally some quick stats are, you know, if you look at open forest, it's probably 100 to 200 pounds of natural browse. That's woody browse that delete the buds and new trees that are popping up. And then a little bit of forbs and legumes in there. There's 100 to 200 pounds. Mm-hmm. So if you open that canopy up and you start letting sunlight in there and let all this new regeneration take place, I mean, you can bring it to 2,000 to 3,000 pounds per acre. Well, that's an immense difference. So that's going to be able to sustain more deer.
Yeah.
Now, if you're also adding things like grains and legumes, clovers, soybeans, stuff like that, it's clearly going to create a massive amount of sustenance for the deer. And what I would tell people is, you know, it's critically important to have that stuff like a grain in like December, January, February. I mean, look at January this year when we had that snowstorm. Well, had that not let up and it turned to basically summer now, say that it kept up for a month and a half or 2 months at that pace. The guys that are like, yeah, I had very little forest browse and I had no food plots or very little food plots, they would have ate through those food plots. Their forest browse would be gone, and those deer would have been in rough shape. Stressed, for sure. Stressed big time. And folks probably listening to this will know this. Like, if you didn't have ample food and ample browse, you probably saw significantly more bucks shed their antlers earlier. Mm-hmm. And that's a sign of stress. So, yeah, just having enough food so you're like, hey, in springtime, there's still some food left. Maybe it's a grain. And then it's hard to quantify this. It's hard to understand this unless you're really in tune with it. But to look at your forest browse, I mean, forest browse could sustain them without food plots, period. I mean, if you had excellent forest browse, you wouldn't need really food plots at all. It makes hunting a little more difficult, and it's not ideal because food plots do offer a lot of nutrition. But absolutely, forest browse is fantastic. It's just people don't understand what good looks like a lot of the times. And they don't keep up with it, and it's a lot of work. So is food plots, though.
Yeah, yeah. Is there a tree or a grass or some kind, maybe a multiflower rose, like an invasive species type of product or plant or vegetation that is a killer, or it goes against what you're trying to do, and that's why you remove them?
Yeah, I would say bush honeysuckle would be the worst one, just because it keeps everything else out. Multiflower rose, on the other hand, it does get a little bit out of hand, but if it gets out of hand, it's pretty easy to treat, and it usually never takes over a forest like bush honeysuckle does. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if bush honeysuckle takes over your whole understory, you're going to have no natural browse for the most part. Multiflower rose, they'll actually eat multiflower rose as much as I don't like it. I just try and control multiflower rose. And if it gets real bad in pockets, you can do everything from treat it with herbicides to burning it to whatever, you know, mechanically taking it out. But it doesn't bug me as much. Bush honeysuckle will ruin your nutrition. It will ruin the natural browse. And, you know, the guys are like, well, it's such a thick, nasty mess in there that the big bucks love it. I get that. So the solution there would just be, you know, slowly start converting it. Because I get it. It's good cover, but you can replace that with something far better than bush honeysuckle. I mean, I was in a buddy's farm the other day that had hazelnut and dogwood throughout his kind of open woods. And it's just like, that would blow away bush honeysuckle for cover. And it's providing nutrition. And it's not taking over like bush honeysuckle does. So, you know, double-edged sword with everything. Remove all your bush honeysuckle and do nothing. Yeah. You know, that's probably not good from just a deer wanting to be there thick standpoint, but it would be better for nutrition. So it's just like, how is there another way to do that? Yes, there's always a million ways to solve any given problem. Eradicate the bush honeysuckle in stages and open things up and replace it with something better is the right answer there.
Yeah. What's, you know, from a strategy standpoint, let's say I did some habitat work on my farm, and I know across the nation there's different types of trees and plants that deer will eat. But is there a plant or a tree that deer eat that kind of goes unnoticed, but they like? And so if I was to identify it, I could possibly set up a tree stand by it?
Couple answers to that. Yes. Any kind of new regeneration, like oak regeneration, they'll eat. That's a little trickier, and it's pretty minimal in Iowa, the oak regen. Most regen of any type, if somebody were to go buy a new clear cut, hey, this just got clear cut, and that's clearly more up north, like Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, stuff like that. They'll notice that, and you know, people say, hey, this got clear cut, and now there's a million deer in there. What are they eating? Well, it really doesn't matter necessarily the trees that were clear cut. If they're stump sprouting, you know, it could be a maple, it could be whatever. They're going to eat the stump sprouts, and it could be literally maple, elm, down the list, hickory. So practically speaking, if a guy could come in and do timber stand improvement and have stump sprouts throughout the forest, that's going to have max nutrition and max attraction for the deer, just because that's uniquely so high level nutrition versus like a tree seedling. It'll be okay, but when you have stump sprouts, they're taking their whole root structure, and instead of putting it into a whole tree, now they're put all that energy and nutrition in just the little sprouts, so they're packed. I mean, they're like protein contents of soybeans. So the deer love that. They love it. But like dogwoods, hazelnut, some of the shrubs like that, they love browsing on that stuff. And you'll watch them go through the woods, and they'll browse a little bit on multiflower rose. They'll browse a little bit on, you know, different woody vegetation. And I'll open stuff up where, you know, I've got viney peas and different forbs and legumes. And a lot of times in the summer, you'll see them just eating like ragweed. You're mm-hmm. like, what the world? Yeah, they'll pound ragweed, pigweed, water hemp, all that stuff. Now, in the fall, a lot of that stuff's gone. So, but it's good to have some of that. You know, I would say if I'm on like a permission farm, though, I would probably more gear towards, you know, hunting season and then try and find the mass producing trees. And in Iowa, we still have oaks that are going to put out acorns every single year, like a shingle oak will yeah. put out acorns every year. A white oak might be every two or three, oftentimes three. And if it's a drought year, it could even abort there. But your reds will be more frequent. Your shingle oaks should be yearly. Your bur oak is going to be a little more common. Your white will be almost like the most infrequent. But just figure out where the masses amount of mast is falling, and that'd be a great spot to target. You know, I'd almost rather do that than the natural browse.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned, I'm kind of going backwards here, but the carrying capacity. How do you identify whether or not the carrying capacity is poor, adequate, or there's too many deer on the property?
I look, so what I do and what is practical are probably different things, but I'll look at, like, if you stand up on your truck, for example, by a field, as you just get elevated a little bit and look down at your field line, and if you see a layer about, I don't know, chest high to head high, where you can see where it's like no vegetation on the trees when you look at the forest, and you, there's this line, you know that they've browsed everything below that line. Like, whoa, there is a lot of browse lacking. And I'm just good at going through my farm and saying, hey, there's lots of open space in the forest. There's lots of regeneration. And I still see buds now. And it'd kind of be like looking at your food plots now. Well, if I knew my food plots had not a grain of corn or soybeans or a brassica or whatever, if it was gone in November, that's a problem. I want them, you know, I clearly want it December, January, February. Well, I can kind of assess that in the forest too. You know, is there still food for them? Is there still buds around? Is there still different things they're browsing on? In my farm, there is. So I would look at it a lot like your food plots. And if your food plots are running out and they're gone in November, you got a problem. You know, it's either too many deer or not enough food. And I would say the vast majority of the time, it's not too many deer. You know, it's just you need to make your food plots bigger. It's not enough. And there's also things, you know, in a little bit higher density areas, you know, planting clovers that can withstand browsing and really, you know, put the nutrition to them, get the lime right, or the pH, you know, and the nutrients right, keep them mowed and lush or sprayed or whatever, fairly weed-free. And they can sustain a lot of deer because they're constantly growing back, of course.
Yeah.
And a lot of my clover plots, I'll kind of, or even alfalfa, you know, I'll put them to a size where it's like, I really don't need to mow them because I've got them to a size where the deer keep them mowed for me. Mm-hmm. And I'll just clean them up every now and again, but the deer kind of take care of them. And if I planted 10 times as many, I'd have to just mow it and I'm kind of wasting my time. But if I planted 10 times less, the deer would just, they'd eat it to nothing. So yeah. You got to kind of find that balance.
Yeah. Yeah. That farm that you helped me load that deer on this year, that farm is 100% from the chest down. Like they have eaten every single leaf off the ground, off, you know, everything. And so, my goal is I'm hoping that I can talk with the landowner and that I can maybe do a little bit of something, just something to give them maybe a little bit more browse. My main concern as someone who doesn't have the resources that you have as far as the like planning food plots or even the knowledge is to just get more deer to stay on that farm. You know, they're obviously going to go other places for food. But I really am hoping that I can talk the landowner into letting me do some hinge cutting or something like that.
See, I was thinking the same thing because I was going to contact that landowner and try and buy that farm. So practically speaking, I would say most guys listening to this with, hey, I don't have a lot of resources, exactly how I started. I didn't know a thing about all this stuff way yeah. back. I mean, I was horrible. A chainsaw mm-hmm. is a resource. And then you need knowledge yep. behind it. And the second thing when it comes to food plots, a bag cedar with some clover.
Yeah.
It's not hard. Neither one of them are expensive. Clover, really, you don't need much knowledge. You just need maybe permission. Hey, could I interseed this part of the pasture or this little edge over here or something, you know?
Yeah.
But if I loaded up one of those red bag cedars, loaded it with clover, like Alice White, Red, Alsike, Ladino, maybe a couple others, Frosty Brisim, for example. And I emptied that bag cedar out on a couple areas. That's going to be a lot of food. That's it. Now, there's more to it, like, well, could you fertilize it? Could you lime it? Sure. But at a basic level, a full red bag cedar with clovers would do a massive amount of difference on a farm. Massive. Mm-hmm. And it would feed them all summer, all fall, and even into the winter. They'll be, you know, that stuff stays pretty green. So, you know, that's an easy one. You know, spreading rye. A lot of farmers won't mind that. Hey, could I spread some rye? You know, and a lot of them are doing it anyways or want to do it anyways. And some of them don't even have time to help build the soil. I mean, it's really good for the soil to have cover crops. So if I told a farmer, hey, could I spread some cover crops? And I'll take care of the bill. A lot of them, if they have a little bit of education, would probably be pretty receptive to that. So I would say starting out, a chainsaw with some weed, like stuff that's just of no value. It's taken over the forest. It's junk. Like I can make that list. Come up with 5 trees in your area that are kind of junky. Won't hurt a thing to cut them. Start cutting those. And if you want to hinge them a little bit, fine. If you want to flush cut them, fine. Whatever. And then just get some clovers or rye and maybe try and work with the farmer on leaving a little bit of grain and make it worth his while. That's a great start for anybody. And again, you're probably ahead of 99% of the farms out there, which, you know, most of them are doing nothing. Yeah. So great start right there.
Yeah. Is this a competition at all? And what I mean by that is habitat management a competition between you and your neighbors?
No, I don't. A lot of people think of it as a competition. It's kind of like, it's kind of like the states that allow baiting. It's like, how many bait piles can I get in? And I talked to my buddies, not faulting them a bit, but they're like, dude, my bait ran out and the deer went over to the neighbors and got shot. I got to make sure I keep my bait filled up. I didn't even like baiting, but I just bait because if I don't, the deer leave. Well, people do the food plots the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to plant all these food plots and I might have a really junky farm, but it's next to a really great farm. So I'm going to put a food plot out there to pull the deer off so I can shoot them. I mean, and I get it. I'm not throwing stones at that. I'm not trying to be controversial. And there's two sides to that. You know, there's these lines where it gets distasteful. Like really, dude, you know, you're just, you have a ground that's worthless. It's never been hunted forever. And then you want to plant food and just sit on this dude's fence because you knew he did hard work. And, you know, I guess there's two sides to that, too. And I don't care what people do. But here's the thing. My desire, which doesn't mean a thing, but my desire is I wish everybody made their ground better, whatever that is, whatever it is, for the forest, for the soil, for food plots, for sustaining wildlife. And I plant a lot of food plots that aren't going to impact deer. You know, I like seeing the quail, the turkeys, the pheasants benefit. The whole ecosystem on my farm benefits from all this stuff. Stuff I'm not going to hunt. You know, I don't turkey hunt. I go around and I kill nest predators all year round because my farm was infested with raccoons. Well, you spent a lot of time on that. I do. I spent a good bit of time on that to never turkey hunt. And now my farm is full of pheasants and turkey and quail. So competitively speaking, it's like, no, my neighbors down the road, I help them with this stuff. Do this, this, this. How do I do my CRP? Do plant this, this, and this. Here's the steps. Here's how you make it great. Here's how you manage your forest. I mean, within a 10-mile radius of my farm, I've been on a dozen farms helping them do TSI. Could that suck deer off of my farm? Sure. Do I care? No, because the more people that do it, it's going to be better for everybody.
Yeah.
I don't look at it as a competition. I'm sure many, many people do.
Yeah. I do have to ask this question, though. Has there ever been a buck that has maybe been living on your farm and your neighbor's farm, and you're like, God, I got to do something on my farm to pull them in just a little bit further, and then it actually worked?
Yeah, probably. I'm at a different stage. Like now, if a deer lived on my neighbor's farm and I know he grew them, and he was after him. There's a little bit of me that's like, now it's because I'm older. Yeah. And I was not like this when I was younger. I'm like, I want you to shoot him. You grew him.
Yeah.
You earned it. But that, and that's not a right or wrong. That's just my philosophy now.
Yeah.
And how I look at it. 10 years ago, I'd be like, how do I get him over here?
Yeah.
I want to get a crack.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just want to make my ground as good as possible. And if that deer gives me a shot, if I have a legitimate chance and I'm not just sitting on the fence looking into my neighbor's ground, I personally would feel guilty about that. I don't even hunt by my neighbor's borders. I just don't. And I don't care if people do, whatever. I just don't, because I like being away from people. I think the neighbors usually screw it up anyway. But on the flip side, if a neighbor does something and they pull a deer off of my farm and they shoot it, if it's a mature buck, I'm like, props, good for you. If it's a young buck, if they tell me they're going to shoot a young buck, hey, man, we're going to shoot everything that walks. I just say, okay, that's fine. They can do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only issue I have, and it's off topic here, but is if they tell me, hey, we're on the program. We want to grow mature deer, and we're going to pass whatever. We're going to pass great three-year-olds. And all of a sudden, they shoot all the good three-year-olds. Well, then I have a problem, because that's not what we agreed on. That's not what you told me.
Yeah.
Your words should be worth something.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's way too off base, but you know, that you don't own the deer. I don't. And if a neighbor shoots a giant buck that was on my farm, great. I will be the first one to shake their hands. The jealousy bug has left me years ago. I did have it.
Mm-hmm.
I did have it when I was younger. I'll totally admit it. But the jealousy bug now, no, I'm not jealous. I'm happy for him. And I think the thing that changed my mind, one was, yeah, I shot big deer and that helps.
Mm-hmm.
But I just knew when I was jealous of other people, it made me like almost not like hunting as much. It was a pressure to shoot a buck because I got to get a big one. And I don't like that. I want to hunt because I love it. And I could feel that it made me have a little tint of like, you know, I just didn't enjoy it as much. So I really worked on making sure I was happy for other people when they shot a giant. Now, if I had a once in a lifetime buck on my farm and I put everything I had and I saw that deer since he was 2 years old, I was chasing him that year and the neighbor shot him, would I feel maybe a little bit out of the gate like, darn it, wish I would have got a crack? Yeah.
That's normal, man. That's normal.
Yeah, but I wouldn't be resentful, bitter, jealous, or anything like that. But shoot.
Yep. I feel you. Yeah. I've been there before. When Sam Calora shot that buck that I called Shipwreck, there was a moment there that I was like, oh, dang it, dude. Like, I was so...
Everybody's been there.
So close. But then, because Sam is such a great guy, I just congratulated him, man. I was like, dude, this is so awesome. And so it is, yeah, it burns a little bit sometimes, especially when you're invested, in an animal for multiple years. Right. So,
I'm in a good area. Like, you know, the people around me generally care and they're doing things for the long term.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I had like an outfitter next to me, that's like, no, dude, I'm taking in paid people. And they're just going to shoot a buck. They're not coming back. They don't care what they shoot.
Yeah.
And that's where I'd be like, I would want to remove myself from that situation.
Yeah.
Because they're not invested in our area. They're not. And I'm like, listen, dude, that was our best three-year-old that somebody, I don't care if it was me, anybody around here could have shot someday. And you just got to get your buck because you paid for it. Those are situations I'll just remove myself from. And long ago when I had neighbors like that, I mean, this is clearly one in a million, talking to very few here, but I would just like, I'll sell this farm if it became that much of a headache. So I would say it's somewhat important if somebody's like thinking about where they want to be long-term. I think you'll generally be better off the more like-minded people you're surrounded with, and you'll never see eye to eye ever with all the people, but it does make it easier because people around me care,
mm-hmm.
and they're not just here like, what can I shoot? What can I take? Take, 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 take. They want to give.
Yeah.
They want to give the environment to the farms, and it's not just about shooting a buck.
Yeah. Yeah, man, that's great. Out of curiosity, and I'm only bringing this up because you kind of mentioned it a little bit before we started recording, and that is, you know, obviously the hunting media or the hunting industry always has their take on what is right and wrong for a strategy, for whether that's food plots or hinge cutting or whatever. Is there a topic that a lot of people listen to that they shouldn't listen to, or that goes against what you've seen or what you try to accomplish?
I would say just because somebody's on YouTube does not make them an expert. I don't care if they've been on YouTube for 20 years. And some of these people are friends. I'm like, they've got it completely wrong on certain things, fill in the blank, whatever it is. If we want to try and make it objective, black and white, on habitat, on how they do things. I think this, I'm preaching to the choir to the most people here, but just because somebody has a hunting show and just because they're on YouTube, do not think that they have it all figured out. And guess what? I don't have it all figured out. And when you meet people who are deer experts, which everybody is, every hunter, farmer, the guy at the seed store, everybody's a deer expert.
Mm-hmm.
But when you meet somebody who's a deer expert and they're like, I have it all figured out, don't listen to that guy. Don't.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of bad information out there, and you got to be sharp at sifting through it. I mean, and there's certain things with people where I'm like, hey, that guy, in my opinion, he's got 80% of it right.
Yeah.
Few things I would change, few things I disagree with, but he's got 80% right.
Yeah.
And then there's guys where I'm like, dude, you don't even have 20% right.
Yeah.
I mean, 80% of what you're talking about is crazy. And some of them have fairly large audiences,
yeah,
which, you know, I don't care about that part. I could care less, but just the information is just factually incorrect.
Yeah.
You know, but I guess if, you know, a hunting celebrity or whatever is doing it purely for entertainment and they're not bringing information with, that's an easier one to deal with. But the ones that are giving advice and strategy, there's a lot of garbage out there, but there's a lot of great stuff too. It's just, yeah, it's sifting through anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, any final thoughts in regards to habitat? Maybe, you know, your farm is pretty big and you've collected that land over the course of several years.
30,
right? And so
I started at 12 years old, saving for land. I'm 45 now, so yeah, I guess more.
Yeah.
33 years it took me to do this.
Yeah. And so people, whether they own 1 acre or they own the same amount as you, what?
5 acres. Yeah. That's what I have. 5.
You have 5 acres?
5 acres.
Yeah, you do. Sure do, Skip. What are some tips, or not necessarily tips, just some final thoughts on what they can do to improve the habitat, whether they love turkey, whether they love pollinators, whether they love birds, whether they love deer?
So start with something, and it does not need to be significant. Like I said, if you went out there and you had permission on 10 acres and the landowner said, yeah, you could take care of some of these trees that are junky here. And you did that. Little things like that. I spread some seed over here. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of room with the governmental programs, which I love what they do. I guess the only part of the governmental programs I don't like is just that as a country, we're bankrupt. And they're throwing money out that they shouldn't be throwing out. But beyond that, they're great. So look at the conservation steward programs, look at EQIP funds, look at REAP funds. And all of a sudden you're like, hey, I'd love to do all these programs, or I'd love to do these improvements. Oh, they'll pay me to do them? Yeah. Yeah, they'll pay me to do them. So that's another way to get a landowner involved. Or even if you have permission, like, hey, if I talk to the NRCS office or whatever, and I can get these okayed, I'll do them.
Mm-hmm.
You can have the money. It won't cost you a thing, and I'll do the work. You take the money, whatever. So I think there's a lot of creative ways of doing little projects. So I would say anybody, even if you don't own land, if you are friends with a landowner, could call the NRCS office and say, hey, what kind of programs do you have where I could maybe make some conservation improvements, some habitat improvements down the list? I mean, they'll pay you for native grasses. They'll pay you for doing strips of food plots in certain situations.
Yeah.
Timber work, massive amounts of money. I mean, $13 billion just got injected into some of the EQIP programs. Massive amounts of money because Biden wants to buy your vote. So, I mean, it's not going to work with me. I'll take some of the money, which is my own money. I'm just taking some back. But yeah, I mean, so there's financial incentives. And then you're like, hey, I'm battling, trying to convince this landowner to do these little things. Well, when you add, hey, you'll get paid to do it, makes it pretty easy. Yeah. And the other stuff, like I mentioned, the chainsaw, the bag with, clover or rye or something like that, we're talking like $20, $50, $100 expenses on making some fairly substantial gains. So, there's a million things that people can get involved in. I think we do a pretty good job on Iowa Whitetail on, you know, laying out a lot of the programs, a lot of the improvements, habitat stuff. Ask a question there because that's free. That's non-biased. We're not trying to sell anything. That'd be a great place. Hey, I got this question on this farm. Throw it up there. You know, so a lot of ways people can go there.
Yeah. Well, Skip, man, as always, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to chat about habitat, chat about deer hunting, and the passion that we both share for the outdoors. So, Skip, man, I'll let you get back to farm work now.
Keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for having me.